The Guardian.
If I wake up in the morning, when I look outside it's storming, and if it seems the whole world's covered by clouds of grey.
Hello and welcome to Phil Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I meet Aboriginal director Warwick Thornton, who describes his debut feature, Samson and Delilah, as a survival love story. And, tremble, I speak to Jenny Agutter as The Nice One, The Railway Children, is re-released after 40 years. Zan Brooks joins me to run a critical eye over three new releases, Matthew Vaughan's Kick-Ass, Clash of the Titans, newly remade with the cream of British cinema vamping it up, and Alan Coulter's romantic drama, Remember Me. Turn on your high-energy particle accelerators. This is Film Weekly.
The sweet love that you give will make it shine.
Samson and Delilah is the debut feature from Australian director Warwick Thornton, and it won him the Camera d'Or at Cannes last year. Filmed in and around Alice Springs, it tells the love story of two Aboriginal teenagers in a remote community in the central Australian desert. Samson and Delilah soon discover that life outside their community can be harsh, and this is a film of tough love and a life lived on the margins.
I've been hassled by the cops nearly all my life. People try to keep me so blind. Oi, oi, oi! I don't know where I'm going half the time. We have survived the white man's world. And you know, you can't change that. You're mob hungry. Now, in order for us mob to survive, you mob are gonna have to start chucking in. Because these noodles ain't cheap.
I caught up with director Warwick Thornton when he visited London last week, and I wanted to find out what was behind that biblical name of his film.
There's two key points to the name of the film, Samson and Delilah. And one is that, you know, we have this sort of history of missionaries and missions, and so we do have biblical names, a lot of them, because Aboriginal people embraced Christianity very, very quickly when it came, which was sort of in the, you know, just the turn of the century in Central Australia. So we do have Samson and Delilahs walking around, as well as I was looking for a name that actually would be incredibly empowering in a sense. And we had the haircutting scene, and I'd actually written the film before I actually had the name of the film in a sense, and Samson was always Samson in the script, but I never had Delilah, and I'm kind of work out what's her name in the film. And you know, and then my wife said, well, it's obviously Delilah, you dickhead. And it was like, oh, of course it is. And that works with the hair cutting. Oh, my God, everything's... Oh,
so she was already cutting her hair. I mean, obviously, in Samson and Delilah, he gets the haircut, but obviously the roles are reversed. That's a traditional sign of grieving, because one of the gut-wrenching scenes in your film is a central scene. It's not a spoiler that she cuts her hair in response to a family death. Yeah. That would happen, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's natural culture and lore, and it's a progression of, you know, of if you're going to do any story in these communities, that if someone dies, you go into grieving and sort of mourning and you cut all your hair off. So that's actually something we own just as much as the biblical story, Samson and Delilah. So, you know, kind of it all just gelled really beautifully.
Your two leads, can you tell me about where you found them, how you got to work with them? Because they're obviously non-professional actors, but that and what that actually brings to it, because it's a strange process watching non-professional actors for a professional critic, for example, because they sort of speak outside the normal realms of cultured response, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is a lack of dialogue in the film, so it actually, for them, it was a lot more work, in a sense. You know, they don't have the keywords like happy, sad, angry to use in scenes. And when I was writing the script, I knew that I was going to use basically non-actors, because as a first-time feature director, I needed backup to help me make this film. And I could have brought really amazing actors from down south, but I would have had to have spent weeks in sort of a form of culture shock trying to get them into the persona of these kids who live in these communities. I was like, well, why don't I just get kids from these communities and teach them how to act? It's going to be quicker, and they're going to back me up because they understand the world that Samson and Delilah live in. Yeah, we used to start it off in Aboriginal communities, you know. People just started suggesting names, and then we'd talk to their families, bring the kids into Alice Springs and meet them and take photos and ask them if they actually want to be in a film. Actually, some kids said no. It's like, do you want to be in a big major motion picture? You know, no. It's like, okay, cool.
I assume they're slightly more cinema savvy, or at least media savvy.
Absolutely, you know, and that's part of the tragedy of what they're doing, because, you know, Aboriginal culture is incredibly demanding, and it's, you know, it's very, very strict. You've got these kids who are sort of trying to run away from that, because, and they see this sort of MTV concept of, you know, sort of booty and Lamborghinis and get rich quick gangster kind of concept, that sort of Black American commercial concept, and they're embracing that sort of stuff and really running the hell away from Indigenous law and culture. You know, when you're in a community like this here and you've got a TV, you've got nothing, you don't have any food, but you're watching these guys with, you know, 20 half-naked women around them, and they're sort of dancing on top of Ferraris with all this gold and money and food. It's a really hypocritic kind of concept.
And those images, that culture has infected the Aboriginal culture, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the brand names. You know, you've got, and I think this is universal as well. Yeah. You know, but you know, you've got families who have no money, no food, and you've got these kids walking around with $200 Nikes on. You know, it's like, how does that fit in the world?
I thought the look was fantastic. You're the cameraman yourself, aren't you? You're the kind of Steven Soderbergh thing here. You've got the camera and you're directing.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been a cinematographer for 20 years, so it was one of those sort of pleasures, in a sense. You know, this is my first feature film as a director, and it's taken a couple of 5 and 10 minute films to really try and learn enough of the craft of directing to be able to survive Samson and Delilah, you know, and I've got so much more to learn as a director, but the cinematography side of it is just pleasure for me now. I've been doing it for so long, it was so relaxing and so much fun, you know, but the film was designed that way too. Because Rowan and Marissa, it's the first time they've actually been on a film set and they're acting for the first time, I desperately didn't want a whole massive crew between the director and these kids, so for me to have the camera on my shoulder, it became really personal then, and really a really small nurturing kind of environment for him. Sabes, pasa el tiempo y no te veo. Cada vez estás más lejos y yo gusto más de ti. Porque who's the Mexican singer? Beautiful music. Well, that's a lot of music in your film, actually. Not just the Mexican, but I was intrigued to see Aboriginals listen to country music a lot. That's a really strange kind of connection. And then that beautiful Mexican singer that she wafts through the cassette when she goes to the car. Yeah, it's a lady named Ana Gabriela. And, you know, I grew up on country and western music. You know, I think my first memory had, you know, a Charlie Pride soundtrack behind it. Because country and western, there's a connection between Indigenous people. They're incredibly sad songs about country. And they kind of, we grew up on ranch as sort of slave labour, mustering cows, you know, on cattle stations. So there's kind of a really clear, defined connection. And I really loved Ana Gabriela because I had no idea what she was singing about, but it was just pure emotion. And I was looking for a kind of almost like a swan song for Delilah, some kind of her theme. And I found that these Ana Gabriela songs, and they were kind of like, this is Delilah's concept of love. She's playing these songs because this is the kind of love that she wants to feel when she falls in love. And the only thing she's got is this sort of mad Neanderthalic Samson, you know what I mean, who's completely crazy and throws rocks at her. But, you know, she wants the Ana Gabriela version of love.
Yeah. It's a beautiful image, and thank God you didn't put Tom Jones's Delilah on there. Thank you so much, Warwick. I hate that bloody song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Congratulations on Samson and Delilah. And the highly unusual Samson and Delilah opens in cinemas this Friday, April the 2nd. Last week on the show, how could you forget, we gave you the chance to win a very attractive sleeveless hoodie to celebrate the release of Michael Caine's Harry Brown on DVD and Blu-ray. To win it, you had to name three other famous Harrys that Michael Caine has played and in which films. You could, of course, have chosen Harry Palmer in The Ipcress File and many other films. Or you could have had Harry Tristan Dean from Gambit, 1968, with the lovely Shirley MacLaine. Or you might have chosen Harry Anders in his self-produced gangster film Blue Ice from 1992. Many of you answered, and the winner is... I shuffle my papers. The winner is Corinne Orton from Edinburgh. Congratulations to you, Corinne. I want to see you running in that sleeveless hoodie up Arthur's seat, getting to the top, putting the hood on and doing a kind of Rocky pose. That's going to be great. Well done, Corinne Orton. And thanks to the others who entered that competition. Haven't got one for you this week, but keep listening to Film Weekly. You never know when the goodies might turn up again. Now, that banshee wail and gnashing of teeth can mean only one thing. Zan Brooks has entered the pod. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you, Jason. It's lovely to be here.
We had Peter Bradshaw in your absence last week.
How'd he do?
He was all right. Yeah. You know, he was all right. He was no Zan Brooks. You know, I told him that at the end.
I'm no Peter.
This week, Zan, we're going to look at Kick-Ass. We're going to look at Clash of the Titans. And then we're going to discuss Remember Me. But let's start with Kick-Ass, which is the director of Layer Cake and Stardust, Matthew Vaughn, adapting a comic book with the help of Jonathan Ross's Mrs. Jane Goldman about an ordinary nerd played by Aaron Johnson who decides to turn superhero.
I was just a regular guy.
Hey, gorgeous.
Hey, my only superpower was being invisible to girls. But the comic books had it wrong. You don't need a power to be a superhero.
Leave him alone! It's none of your business!
Yes, it is.
Hey, there's a dude dressed like a superhero out there fighting a bunch of guys.
Zan, kick ass, kick ass. So you say one, I say the other. But do you like it?
I did like it, yes, with some sort of major reservations. I think, you know, the thing to remember about this is a comic book movie based on a comic book about comic books.
Yeah.
So it's about as kind of postmodern and self-referential and up itself as you can possibly get.
But is it? I mean, is it a Baudrillardian exercise in postmodernism? No, people being smart? And
it's a gaudy piece of pop art, I guess. It name-checks a lot of things. That the character played by Aaron Johnson, who is a wannabe superhero who runs around in a wetsuit, becomes a star courtesy of his MySpace profile and being put on YouTube and goes viral. So it has a lot of things to say about, you know, the have-a-go heroics and the power of the internet and the weird mercurial nature of fame. I don't think it has anything profound to say about these things. It skitters along the surface of a lot of stuff. But within that, it is perfectly entertaining.
So you've got Aaron Johnson, who was recently in Nowhere Boy and is now famous for sort of siring Sam Taylor Wood's child. Good luck to them. He's this nerd and he's got his friends, the kind of friends, and they hang out in a comic store, and then he gets the wetsuit and he becomes this kick-ass hero. But then he does meet some real superheroes.
And it has to be said that his first attempts at comic book heroics don't go down very well, and he gets beaten to a pulp. But this actually works in his favour because he suffers terrible nerve damage, which means that he can then absorb more blows.
Because he gets rebuilt.
He gets like rebuilt, and that is his kind of superpower. He then goes on to meet Nicolas Cage. It's a very neat, funny performance from Cage, this. He's sort of channeling the spirit of Adam West out of the old Batman TV shows with that slightly stilted dialogue and lots of aphorisms.
But he does still a lot of yee-haing and kind of strange kind
He's
of
He's a big comic
Cage
book fan, Nick Cage, didn't he? He always wanted to play Superman, for
did
real.
He
did, yeah, he did.
Because he looks like Stanley Tucci's serial killer from The Lovely Bones.
He does, he's better suited to this kind of comic book movie.
I'd like to see him as a serial killer. Mr. Cage, if you're listening.
Most controversially, Nicolas Cage's daughter, Hit Girl, played by Chloe Moretz, who is a foul-mouthed, psycho-killer 11-year-old.
So why is this controversial?
Why is it controversial? Because she uses what is coyly known as the C-word when she's killing her foes. I actually don't have a problem with that at all. I mean, I think that 11-year-old kids do use the C-word. They're using them, we speak, in every school up and down the country. What they don't do, I guess, is kill people in slow motion and ultra-violent styling.
Like she's a little Tasmanian devil.
She is, yeah. So if you can have a problem with this 11-year-old, maybe have a problem with the comic book violence that she's associated with.
I did. I don't have a problem with the C-word. I had quite a lot of problem with the violence on it because it is supposed to be funny.
It's supposed to be funny and it's targeted at kids.
Yeah, I didn't laugh once.
People are comparing this to Kill Bill and Pulp Fiction and things like that, which at least I think had an 18 certificate. This has a 15 certificate and is very much going for the almost the tweeny demographic here.
Does it have a 15 certificate?
Yes, it does.
Which is just bizarre because it is clearly aimed at 10-year-olds who will think it's really cool, I should imagine. So I have quite a problem with
this film. That's the thing to fix on, I think. Don't worry about the language. Worry about the actual violence.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of violence here. It's not comic book violence. It isn't like Tarantino where the entire kind of rooms of samurais.
It's pretty grueling.
It's quite tough. It's quite grueling. troubling, and it's almost not, it's quite real. It's not like funny kapow superhero kind of, and the sense that these people, are they on the side of justice? I don't really know. Are they good for evil? They kind of wipe out a kind of mafia family run by Mark Strong. I wasn't sure of the tone of this film at all. I don't think Matthew Vaughn really got that right.
I'm not sure he did. Having said that, I don't have a problem with movies that are amoral and that feature amoral characters and characters that you're not quite sure where they fit or what they're doing necessarily. But you're right that when it is pitched at a certain audience, then that comes freighted of all kinds of issues.
And I'm not really a moral kind of guy.
No, you're not.
Thank you very much. I'd say I'm dissolute, in fact. I do like to laugh. And there are the kind of little nods to Tarantino where she kind of dresses up as a little schoolgirl in plaits, and then there's a sort of kind of Ennio Morricone kind of score going on. And it just kept sort of to remind me that Tarantino gets that tone right. If for all what people worry about Tarantino, he does get the jokey postmodernism, the distancing, and his referencing right. This one, I didn't feel this one knew is what
like
it was doing.
This one is like a sort of bloodbath at Claire's Accessories, isn't it? And it doesn't quite fit. It's not quite the right stage for it.
Not to give a spoiler, but the sort of climax involves this little 13-year-old getting quite a beating herself. Like, she gets actually beaten up by Mark Strong. And that I had real problems with. I was like, well, you know, why don't you go ahead and rape her? That'll be fine. Because he starts smacking her around. I mean, I felt really uncomfortable. And by that point, my contempt for the film was almost utter, and I began hating the film with almost every fibre in my being.
I didn't hate it. I found it was fast and well made up to a point. I think maybe it's a bit incoherent. It's a series of incidents and set pieces, and I don't think it actually ever becomes more than that. But it's certainly put together with brio and energy. It's sitting awfully on the fence here. I like the fact that sometimes it made me uncomfortable. I think that's fine.
That's a good thing to do.
But other times, there were certain sticking points that I had with it.
Right, okay. I mean, I don't know. A lot of people do love it.
It's getting great reviews, and I think it's going to do really well.
Yeah, I think you might be right as well, but I can't say that I would pan on my heart recommend it to anyone, really, because I thought it was awful, especially the bit where there's a massive poster of Claudia Schiffer kind of in her underwear lying on the table. That's his wife.
That's his wife.
And he's just going, look at me. Not only am I making a film that's going to be a big hit with my friend Jonathan Ross and his wife, I've also got a really fit wife who can be massive and wears tights.
Fair play to Matthew Vaughn.
We all want to be
Matthew.
I don't want to be Matthew Vaughn at all. I hated his film Stardust before. I thought it was
and Layer Cake was bad.
Yeah, and Layer Cake really wasn't very clever. I thought it was, but wasn't. At least it had Daniel
Craig.
But
this is going to be the film that launches him
into the A-list of Hollywood nonsense, and he can go and make rubbish in Hollywood as far as I'm concerned. Matthew Vaughn, au revoir to you. Zan, let's move on to Clash of the Titans. Now, I remember 1981 and all that, as I'm sure you do. Director Louis Leterrier visits that 1981 epic, plunging us back into myth as Perseus, played by Sam Worthington, goes in search of the Medusa's head to save Andromeda in what can only be called a Kraken tale.
Turn them on each other.
One day, somebody's gonna have to make a stand. One day, somebody's gotta say enough.
If I do this, I do it as a man.
But you are not just a man.
Zan, all puns aside, no, let's not. Let's use as many puns as we can. I remember 1981. I remember going to see it in the cinema, do you?
Yeah, I did. I went to see it at the cinema. And do you know, thinking back, I worry that I was a terribly snooty, snobby little kid because I don't remember liking it very much.
What was it about? Terrible? Was it the shabbiness of Harryhausen's effects?
It wasn't Bergman, was it? My 11-year-old self rebelled and demanded some Tarkovsky. No, I don't think I really liked it. It felt a bit cheesy and hammy.
Yeah,
and I think I'd probably just seen Raiders of the Lost Ark and thought that was great. And so Clash of the Titans seemed very stiff and antiquated.
It was very old-fashioned, given that Battlestar Galactica, I think, was on at the same time, Star Wars, and all kind of... I kind of like that old-fashionedness because I don't like Star Wars. As you know, I don't really like sci-fi and I don't like superhero movies, as you probably just heard. But I do like a bit of sword and sandal stuff.
You're a classicist.
I think I am. I think there's a Virgil in me. But I really enjoyed the Ray Harryhausen stuff. I always loved, mainly because he made Jason and the Argonauts. Mm. And it was the first time I'd seen a character called Jason on the screen.
Oh, right.
And I thought, wow.
This was before Friday the 13th.
Yes, exactly, which I've never quite identified it with. But the guy who fells those tin soldiers, always been a fan. And I really did like the saber-toothed tiger in Clash of the Titans. Mm. And I found I love a bit of Greek myth made on screen. This film, however,
really... There's a however here.
It doesn't need to have been made Greek myth at all. In fact, there are no Titans in this Clash of the Titans. So I think they're kind of done with by the prologue, not to give too much of a spoiler away.
Yeah, it's all gods and men, isn't it?
Yeah.
And demigods.
Wither the Titans.
Wither the Titans.
They're now managed by Denzel Washington and Sandra Bullock, no doubt, in some southern university. This is Louis Leterrier, whose previous contribution to film culture was Danny the Dog. Which I tremendously enjoyed.
And Hulk, didn't he?
Did he do Hulk?
Yeah, I think he did Hulk.
Which one?
The last one. The bad one.
Oh, okay. The worst one, yeah. Than Ang Lee's. Yes, he did. But this was famously reshot in 3D after the kind of fuss of Avatar. Mm. They kind of went, oh, we're making through the Clash of Titans. We better do some 3D. I have to say it's kind of the worst example. It's worse than 3D was in the 1950s, this film.
It's a fairly pointless 3D exercise, isn't it? But the 3D effects look almost as two-dimensional as the characters. And the characters are pretty flat
I mean, I think that they're better drawn, certainly in Greek myth, in Homer and in Virgil.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was either overacting wildly or staring blankly into the middle distance as though sort of looking for an auto cue that wasn't there.
It's that strange mix. Do they go for the camp that so put you off in the 1981 version, or do they take it seriously? And I think Sam Worthington's Perseus was taking it all very
seriously.
Whereas
Ralph Fiennes is going for the camp.
Oh, my God.
Hades.
What did he look like, Ralph Fiennes?
I don't know. He looked like a forlorn old wizard, didn't he?
He did all giant haystacks.
Yeah, he looked like Catweasel.
Yeah, because the 3D in this one, it just adds another bit behind them. It's like an Easter egg sort of mould clapped on their back, for which I'm sure Gemma Arterton, who kind of comes out double the size because of this, will not thank them at all. She looked gigantic, looked like she had an enormous arse.
I always thought that she was auditioning for... she was auditioning for a Timotei ad, wasn't she? She kept sort of suddenly appearing in the forest in her white gown. And I thought she's going to wash her hair any minute.
Yeah, and was she supposed to be visible? Because she plays Io, who's his kind of mystical guide.
I think
she
is, but again, I was confused because there was a point where it seemed that only Perseus could see her, and then other people start vaguely acknowledging her presence.
Yeah, because she's kind of more attractive than some of the other.
She's more attractive than the giant scorpions and, is it Jason Fleming?
Jason Fleming, the monster. Who plays something like...
You know, I think we're agreed that this was rubbish.
Yeah.
And yet about halfway through, I started to really enjoy it.
I stopped kind of worrying about, like, why isn't this intelligent? Why doesn't it kind of examine God and man? And then
as soon as the scorpions arrive, it's the old truism, isn't there? There's nothing wrong with a film that an attack of giant scorpions can't solve. And as soon as they popped up, I thought, this is all right now.
Yeah, and it was really good.
And it was really good. Yeah. And then he fights the Medusa, and then the Kraken comes. And all of that sort of bickering between the men and the gods gets pushed to the sidelines, and it's just non-stop action.
I think there's a lot of this film on a cutting room floor somewhere where someone went, right, we've got to make it 3D, we've got to get it done. And they just went for the whole fairground ride kind of Disney approach to it. There's not really any violence in it. There's not really any sexuality in it.
No, not really. Some wonderful, you'll appreciate the wonderful classical dialogue in this film. There's the great bit where Perseus goes in to meet the Medusa, and his advice is, don't look this bitch in the eyes.
Yes. Which, and could you give me that in the original Greek?
Later.
But I did. It does kind of go along at quite a clip and become sort of camper. Than I said, it kind of opts for camp halfway through. And I did like the scorpions very much. They're supposed to be in Argos, and I just thought, well, it looks like Argos have supplied the props and the set.
There's the wonderful notion of Perseus fighting the gods to save Argos.
Please fill in your forms and queue up at the front. I know that sniggering at the back like little prep school boys. We're going to whiz into the present day now. Back in New York, actually, where we were for Kick-Ass. But we'll be here for Remember Me, which stars Robert Pattinson, who I'm sure you know as R-Pat.
Mm, I do.
Zan. He's well known, of course, from Twilight and New Moon, and is the world's biggest heartthrob at the moment. He stars here as a rebellious NYU college student who's mourning the death of his older brother several years earlier. And what do you know? He falls in love with a cop's daughter, played by Emily Ravin, who's also mourning someone, her lost mother.
Gandhi said that whatever you do in life will be insignificant. But it's very important that you do it.
Officer, those two were just trying to stop it.
Go home. Hey, don't.
I tend to agree with the first part.
Could do worse than have a father who bails you out of jail.
I don't want to be bailed out of anything.
As you might suggest from all the mourning going on, this is a rather mopey sort of movie.
Yeah, there's some velvet mourning going on in this film, isn't there? A lot of tortured, picturesque male brooding from Pattinson here. He's really going for... You know, the first time you see him, he's sitting out on the fire escape smoking a cigarette, trying to be like sort of Brando from the actor's studio days. And it really is giving him license to sort of go for that. What it doesn't give him is much of a script to work with.
About half an hour in, I thought this film was going for the title of most boring film ever made. Literally nothing had happened apart from Arpat showing me his eyebrows.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's all supposedly about the pain in the past and family squabbles and coming of age and things like that. But it's a pretty pallid set of problems these kids are facing, particularly Arpats, who's basically, you know, he's basically sort of rich kid New Yorker, Holden Caulfield sort of type, who's a bit solipsistic and squabbles with his dad, played by Pierce Brosnan, who's actually not bad as the cold-blooded businessman dad. But it is incredibly aimless and meandering. And then right at the end, it reaches for a kind of level of profundity that it really hasn't earned.
Yeah, now, are we allowed to talk about this?
I don't know.
Is it an enormous spoiler?
I got
spoiler.
Told off for supposedly spoiling a film.
Yeah, the Scouting Book for Boys,
yeah,
which I don't know if that
corresponds. I don't give think the ending
spoiled.
Away.
Even if the bloke if he thinks it's spoiled, well, he should go and see it because there's a lot more that you could have spoiled.
There is, yeah. Maybe next time it will.
Yeah, maybe we'll reveal all. Is it a film about mourning and growing and kind of forgiveness, I think, or healing wounds? And
healing then wounds. There's a lot of healing wounds.
There's
in
a
there.
Lot of healing wounds in
physical
there.
Physical and spiritual.
I think it kind of gives the film a sort of massive kind of heft and kind of self-importance.
Self-importance.
That it's not, it hasn't earned at all.
Yeah.
In its 2 hours.
It's true. This film has been criticised because of that, I think. I think justifiably so, but even if you take away those last 5-10 minutes, it's still a pretty poor film.
Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, I don't really feel sorry for Arpat. I mean, has he got it, do you think? Because the people sort of say, well, you look like James Dean. Someone actually even says, I think you're going for that Jimmy Dean thing. You mentioned Brando. He does a lot of kind of, hey, I'm really handsome kind of looks.
He does, but
a lot
I wonder,
of blue steel going on.
I worry if that is the director and the producers requiring that from him. I don't think he's necessarily a bad actor. Mm. But he needs to break out of that little gilded cage to show what he can do.
Yeah, I was like, well, you could a smile would be nice for
a smile. Is nothing
point.
Wrong
can
with
he do
a
that?
Smile.
There's nothing wrong with that, I would say, or a laugh.
Even Brando smiled.
Do you think so?
Occasionally.
Where was that? Missouri Breaks.
In that Tea House of the August Moon.
Yes,
a lot of smirking in there.
So we're looking at Arpats. Emily DeRavin, I thought, was quite nice. Chris Cooper's in it. I mean, it was quite a good lot of talent
good,
in it. Just kind of going
cast,
nowhere, really.
But it was absolutely going nowhere very, very slowly.
That's Remember Me, Zan, which I'm not sure either of us will come the
already.
End of the year. Zan, lovely to see you as ever. You can, of course, catch up with all of Zan's musings on film and his real reviews on the world's finest film website, www.guardian.co.uk/film. The Railway Children. Ah. Is a Lionel Jeffries 1970s film based on the eponymous story by E. Nesbitt. When their father is one day whisked away by police and their idyllic childhood shattered, Roberta, Peter and Phyllis move house, impoverished, to the countryside and pass the time watching the trains on the nearby railway line. They become friendly with Perks, the station porter, played so memorably by Bernard Cribbins, and with an old gentleman who regularly takes the 9:15.
You are the man that waves to us, aren't you?
What are you, please?
Aren't you?
Yes, my dear, I wave.
Oh, will you take this, please? We chose you because we thought you had such a kind face.
Man the doors, please, miss. On the way, Mr. Mitchell!
And you, Mr. Burt.
Now, Lionel Jeffries, who also played Caractacus Potts, of course, in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, died earlier this year, and this, his debut feature, is being re-released on the big screen 40 years after its original success. I caught up to celebrate with its star, Jenny Agutter, and I asked her why Nesbitt's story has lasted the distance.
What Nesbitt was talking about, you know, the new worlds that she was talking about, are things that, you know, are you know, with us in some way. You think that she was writing before the First and Second World War, and those are the two things that really kind of lost the sense of innocence, which, of course, she was maintaining at that time. But you can see these links there with these people, and I think that's probably why the film kind of lasts, in a way.
For a children's tale, it's quite sort of interestingly shot. It's quite, there's some interesting kind of 70s camera work, if you like. Did you know that it would kind of have an enduring appeal?
Not at all. I mean, one is never aware of what's going to happen with something. I was aware that it was really enjoyable to make, and that everybody was putting as much into it as they possibly could, and that we were kind of blessed, things were in our favour. And, you know, but you just don't know what's going to translate, because a film is not the film until the whole thing's edited together. I do remember when I was putting voices on, just seeing the images that Lionel had created and how his script that he had put together, you know, because it is a most beautiful story and a beautiful book and beautifully written, but translating that to film is something else. And he had just done it really well. And then Brian Forbes, who produced it, who was at EMI at the time, really put a lot behind publicising it. And I think that was very important too. And we had a royal premiere and there was lots and lots of fuss about it.
It was a sizeable hit at the time.
It was a sizeable hit at the time. It was the only family film coming out at that particular time as well, because people were, you know, it was a time of quite violent movies, quite different movies, movies about drugs and violence and so. And when Lionel Jeffries said, I've got this lovely family film, this, don't be ridiculous. You know, no one's going to make that sort of film now. And Brian Forbes said, no, it's, you've got to make it, and then got right behind it. And, of course, it did do well. But then time went by, and it was only after 10 years went by, that I suppose, I don't know what started it off again. It must have been shown on television. And I think probably there was a big response to that. And then when it came out on video, people bought it, and they really wanted to show it then to their kids or just see it again.
Yeah. I have to say that I remember not really liking it. I've always thought it was a girl's film when I was a boy.
You know, you'd been of an age where, as a teenager, someone showed you that, you go, oh no, you know, it's not for boys at all. Although, funnily enough, it's the one film that loads of men say they cry, and they won't admit to crying to anything about anything else, and they will admit to crying at The Railway Children.
But what strikes me now watching it is it's very, very funny, and that's the Lionel Jeffries bit, I suppose. There's hardly a scene ends without a little kind of payoff or a little kind of witticism or a little kind of little detail that's very kind of...
Because there's lots of layers in it. I mean, you may have caught it just at an in-between age, because the really little children love the trains. Bernard Cribbins, I mean, is fascinating to watch rushing around, and you've got this wonderful performance from Diana Sheridan. But there's something about it that's mesmeric for little tinies. You know, and through 7, 8, you know, they're just, you know, seeing themselves growing up and watching the children and all. A boy of 15 would have perhaps a problem with it. And then you get to being an adult, and of course then you're looking at it in terms of memory, what it means to you in terms of memory. And then you start to see all the adult things that are in it. And it's layered through with the adults' reactions to what's going on.
The drunken doctor, for example, who has a little kind of hip flask.
Exactly. He's created a real character there, and, you know, he's very rather sad, lonely life that he has, and all he's got is his alcohol, you know.
And there's a sort of sexual frisson between him and your character, I think, or is that me maybe laying it on later without kind of working that out? But I mean,
do you think we should go there today?
The Railway Children, what are you saying?
No, the romance is with the boy, the hound in the tunnel.
Yeah, that's true. Even at the time, you were 17, as you say. So were you caught up with the enchantment of it all, or were you thinking, were you being a teenager, were you saying, well, I'd rather be doing the kind of cooler stuff, the kind of Nick Rogue stuff?
Well, I'd just done Walkabout, and the world that I lived in was the Vietnam War, Woodstock, Hot Pants. I didn't feel very much that I related to the world. But as an actress, a young actor, I related to that story very well. I thought it was a beautiful story. So it was lovely to be part of that. But at the centre of it, there's a family. And there are problems, and there are emotional responses, and there are children growing up, and that will always remain the same. And I think that's, in a way, what you identify with, is just their emotional responses to things. So you follow it as a story and a society that isn't yours, but you still watch the way the people are.
Because there is sexuality and awakening in Walkabout. I suppose, were you aware of that when you were shooting that with Nick Rogue, or did that come together in his amazing edit afterwards?
It's in the book, in a way, in James Vance Marshall's book, and it's very much in Edward Bond's screenplay. And Nick Rogue talked a lot about the film he was making, because he wanted to make it clear what he was... And he showed me pictures of Sidney Nolan's. And although, you know, it's very hard to separate yourself, because I know which question you're asking, but it's very hard to separate yourself at the time from your own age and see it in a different perspective. And looking back, Did I understand absolutely what he was making? Sort of. I understood one aspect of it, which was only the teenager's aspect of it, which was loss of innocence. There was a sensuality about it. It was an extraordinary place and mesmeric and very touching to be there. So I lived in this world. And anyway, when you look at Nick Rowe's films, he's always creating a world in which people live, whatever it is, whether it's performance or Don't Look Now, whatever it is, he's creating a world in which these people exist. And it was very easy in the outback just to live this world and for the place to become overwhelmingly a part of your life and then realise that actually what you could never live that life. You know, so I understood it from that point of view. With Railway Children, did I see myself as very different from it? No, I could understand Roberto fundamentally, whereas I had thought before making it, maybe I'd played it before and I was too old to play it. I wasn't. I was just at an age where it was a change. So I could understand Roberto very well. But the only thing that was different was feeling the world that I was looking at was just, as I say, just very, very foreign, and it could have been on the moon, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Only last year was the another anniversary as well. It all seems to be anniversaries. Was American Werewolf in London as well, which had its
debut. Just coming out with a Blu-ray version of that, I think, at the moment.
I liked American Werewolf.
But you probably saw it when you shouldn't have done it.
Absolutely, yeah. You had to send an older friend's brother in to get it.
And then got really, really scared and didn't dare admit to it. Somebody said to me, I watched it, and my parents weren't there, and I was so scared, and I couldn't say anything about it because I wasn't meant to have seen it.
But all we knew was that there was the shower scene with the girl from the Railway Children, and that was a change of innocence But John Landis is here in the UK at the moment shooting. Are you in touch with him still?
Oh, absolutely no, because in fact I knew him well before doing American Werewolf, and he said, I'm going to make this film, and sometimes you must read the script. And anyway, it happened, and so I got the script, and I don't know what I'd have thought if I didn't know him, because I knew it's a good character, it was well written, but it was a real risk, because it's really kind of razor edge horror comedy. He has an absolute knowledge of film, and he has a way of timing things and doing things. He has this hysterical approach to it all, and it just works.
Jenny Agerton, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to see you.
The Railway Children is re-released on Friday, April the 2nd, digitally restored in your cinemas, and we'll follow up with a DVD re-release a month later.
And there'll be no fancy clothes for you to wear.
And that brings us to the end of another show. My thanks to my guests, to Warwick Thornton and to Jenny Agutter, and of course to Zan Brooks. The music we've used for this week's programme is taken from Samson and Delilah. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on this edition, Ian Chambers. Goodbye, and I won't see you next week. I'm going on holidays. I'm going to Barcelona. Come on, you Reds. But Zan will be here next week, and I'll see you the week after. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.